Coming up, it's Philosophy Talk.
What exactly is a law?
Laws are creations. People have the authority to make them.
Is there a tight connection between morality and the law?
Should we obey the law just because it's the law?
Oh, it's worse than that. The law tells us to do something that bears no relationship to what it is that we're required to do. As a matter of morality, it threatens our capacity for moral agency. The mere immorality of something isn't going to prevent it from being a law.
The time has surely come for the laws to fit their times.
Our guest is Jules Coleman from Yale University.
Look, I teach law, so, and I love law, but you know, you have to really see the dirt in it before you can grow to love it.
Philosophy and the Law.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
After the news.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of 91.7 KALW, local innovative public radio for San Francisco.
We're continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
And from that oasis of thought, our conversation migrates to this oasis of the air, and from the air to the internet via our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org. And you know, now you can listen to Philosophy Talk anywhere, anytime, at least the best of Philosophy Talk, by checking out our new podcast.
Well, Ken, today our discussion is going to be about philosophy and the law. You want to kind of clarify that for me?
Oh, well, yeah, in 30 seconds or less. Look, there are all kinds of laws. There's the laws of nature, the laws of morality, the laws of a religion, the laws of a state. What do you have in mind there? What kind of laws are we going to talk about?
Well, let's start right at the top. There's a difference between laws of nature and all the rest. The rest are normative. Laws of nature are descriptive. There's no sanctions for breaking the law of nature because you can't do it. There's no prison for all the objects that didn't, you know, react opposite and equally to other objects.
Yeah, although sometimes I wish there were, you know.
Right.
But look, you're right. Law is this kind of thing, a law of morality or a law of a political system. It's the kind of thing that you're supposed to obey. You're supposed to obey it. Somebody says, "Why should I do that?" And they say, "It's the law." Or why shouldn't I do that? They say it's the law.
But I guess with different kinds of laws, there's different sanctions. If you disobey God's law, you go to hell. If you disobey George Bush's law, you go to prison. If you disobey morality, you feel guilty. So that's one difference between them.
Right, right. But now here's the question. So look, we're talking about a legal system, the laws of a society, politically established society. As the kind of laws we're talking about. Now, here's a question, though, for you. Well, the first question is, what is a law? What makes something to be a law? I guess an easy answer is, well, it's what the lawmaker says. The law is whatever the lawmaker says, whoever the lawmaker happens to be.
Isn't that going to be circular? Because who gets to be the lawmaker? Well, whoever the law says is the lawmaker.
Well, yeah.
Sounds like it's going to be who's ever strongest to me.
Well, possibly, or who's ever duly elected or duly constituted. But you ask, well, why this procedure? Because that's the procedure we somehow settled upon. But now, if the law is whatever the lawmaker says, and if law is something you're supposed to obey, you know, have you ever looked at the guys who make our laws?
Well, and just look at history. I mean, at one point, if you lived in a northern state, you were supposed to return fugitive slaves to the southern states. People disobeyed that law, and we look back and we admire them. So, I mean, what's the deal with laws?
Yeah, I know. I mean, since laws can be stupid, irrational, absurd, even morally wrong, I mean, how does law get to have any force that you're supposed to obey them? I think it's kind of an interesting question.
Would you suppose sometimes you shouldn't obey the law?
I think that's right. And you know, our roving philosophical reporter, Polly Stryker, went out and talked to some people who make a habit of disobeying what they regard as unjust laws. She files this report.
David Solnit is an activist, and his beliefs have clashed with the law from an early age.
When I was 18, I made a decision that I was going to resist the draft. I wasn't prepared to have them take my life and send me to war. All of us thought there was going to be a war in the Middle East over oil. And so all the kids in the high schools throughout Portland, Oregon, where I was living, began to organize groups and protest it. And through that process, I learned that it's been through non-cooperating with either unjust laws or unjust policies that people have made positive change throughout history.
Solnit says laws are made by the elite and looks to history for understanding.
The history of laws and the governments or states that create them and enforce them through police and armed men, it goes back to the creation of the modern government or state going back to the 15, 1600s. The diggers took over a small plot of land that had been enclosed that used to be common land, and they started to grow food on it to share. They didn't carry swords. They were ordered off the land, and eventually the elite, the aristocracy, or the government, they sent men with swords to attack and kill them. And if you look at the North American Free Trade Agreement, Mexico had to change its constitution to get rid of the communal land system, the ejido system that folks fought a revolution over. And that was when the Zapatistas rose up and said, you know, this is a death sentence for us indigenous people. And so they, you know, they took over 12 towns. They probably broke a lot of laws. But are these laws legitimate?
Most people would rather not break the law to force change, but not David Solnit.
You know, I've been organizing nonviolent direct action and civil disobedience since I was 18, and I'm 42 now. You know, when you ask other people to do something, it's usually good to do it yourself. So that's ended me up in jail and under arrest many, many times. I've been very fortunate. I've never spent more than a couple weeks in jail. I mean, I work as a carpenter, so nobody really asks what my record is when I work on their houses, which is fortunate. I've actually been arrested in civil disobedience with every member of my family, including my mother, which is very cute to get arrested with your mom. Mom, they're arresting us now. Here we go.
It's not all about marching and tear gas. Here's what Solnit did to protest a proposed free trade agreement.
There were protests throughout the Americas, and so we did a solidarity action in the Bay Area and dressed up as Robin Hood and his merry band, and we figured we would go to the heart of where the things that matter were turned into commodities and bought and sold. And so we went to the futures trading floor of the Pacific Stock Exchange. We were 15 people dressed in green, a couple Maid Marians. The first Maid Marian had a bouquet of balloons, and she went up to the security guard with a big smile on her balloons and said, "Hi, we're with Balloons and More, and we have a singing telegram." And so he was very bemused and distracted, and while she did that, the rest of us leaped the turnstiles and sprinted for the trading floor and denounced the lords of industry who are turning our lives and our communities into commodities. The traders on the floor went nuts. Some of them were incredibly hostile and threw food at us, but other ones were actually picking us up and helping us escape. All hell broke loose, and trading literally stopped for 20 minutes because of Robin Hood and his merry band.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Polly Stryker.
Thanks to our roving philosophical reporter, Polly Stryker, and her interviewee, David Solnit, for that interesting report. David is from Portland, so many interesting things come from Portland and Oregon. They're way ahead of their time up there, I think. I'm John Perry, and with me is Ken Taylor.
And we're joined today by Jules Coleman. He's a professor of jurisprudence and philosophy from Yale University. He's co-author of the Oxford Handbook of Jurisprudence and the Philosophy of Law. Jules, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Pleasure to be here.
Hi, Jules. John Perry here.
Hi, John. How are you?
Oh, pretty good. Let me start with what must be an absolutely simple question, but being a philosopher, no doubt you'll turn it into something really complicated. So a law is a statement about what we must do and what we must not do. But not all statements are laws. Which ones are laws and why?
Well, that's not such a simple question. Those of us who think about law tend to distinguish among a variety of different questions. One is, what is law as a system of regulation, a set of rules, a way of governing our relationships with one another? That's a clearly philosophical question, and the ordinary man or woman on the street doesn't tend to ask herself that question. The question you're asking is somewhere in the middle. What makes something a law? What is it to be a law? How do laws differ from other kinds of standards or rules that are not laws? What's their distinctive feature? And I'll get back to that in a second. The third is the kind of practical person's question. What's the law around here? And the person who asks that question is normally asking, you know, what do I have to do in order for my contract to be valid or my will to be valid, or do I have to pay my taxes? And when they're asking for advice and they're trying to negotiate their legal system, and they're tending not to ask particularly philosophical questions, though there are some philosophical questions that are hidden and even that simple inquiry into what is it that I'm free to do around here. But with respect to the question, what is it to be a law as opposed to something that is a requirement of morality or some social organization that you're part of, it's normally something posited by someone who has the authority to make it. And as you pointed out at the very beginning, this invites a kind of bootstrapping or, at worst, circularity about how you get the authority, since the authority itself seems to be rooted in the very idea of law. So laws are things which are posited or created. They're artifacts. They're creations of people who have the authority to make them. And we have no difficulty figuring out who some of those people are, judges, lawyers, legislatures, and we have no difficulty in figuring out some of those people who aren't authorized to do it, namely you and me and Ken.
Wait a minute. And I'm the host. I get to make the law. No, I'm just joking.
Those are the rules. Those are the rules, not the laws.
But when you go back in history, you always find out that it starts by somebody winning a war, right? And then eventually they get to make the laws, and then they get to say who makes the laws.
Or winning an argument, I mean, or something. I mean, there's a complex struggle in many societies to establish lawmaking authority, like think of the American context, right? There's a complex social thing that culminates in, here's where the lawmaking authority show.
Well, yeah, it's, the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, lots of wars.
Right. I mean, so it's complicated stuff. But something establishes some organ or body as the lawmaking authority. But here's the question. You said a law is what that lawmaking authority, I suppose we could add legitimate lawmaking authority or something, right, what that lawmaking authority posits as laws. So anything goes, you know? I mean, so whatever the authority says, within, I don't know, there might be a constitution or something, but whatever that authority ultimately outputs, that's the law? Is that it?
Well, let me distinguish a couple of things. You know, I'm a philosopher. I get paid for this stuff.
Yeah, so do we.
Which is...
Well, we don't get...
Yeah, you don't get paid. Come on.
Yeah.
The law. One of the things about law as an institution is that it claims to be legitimate. So it claims that the reasons it provides us with acting are morally legitimate reasons for acting. Whether it meets this test ever is a different question about whether or not it claims it. Another thing it claims is that there's no area of our life which in principle it cannot enter. That is, there are no constraints on law other than law. There are practical constraints and there are moral constraints in the sense that we can subject law to criticism. But there is nothing in principle that prevents law from acting anywhere in our lives. Now, we normally put some constraints on it in terms of our constitutions that limit the scope of authority. Those are things which are thought to be conditions of securing the support of the people who are regulated, whose lives are regulated by law.
So let me put that crudely. Let me see if I've got this right. Put it crudely. So really, in some sense, the legal authority is in some sense unconstrained. Whatever it says, whatever it articulates as law is there by law. Is that right?
As long as it does it according to the formula for making law and satisfies the constraints, if any, accepted by law for constraints on its own lawmaking authority. Yeah, that's right. And, this is a really important point and is the source of much concern about law, because while law can be a source of good, it can be a source of evil. Bob Dylan, of course, great philosopher, pointed out that you can steal with a pen or a gun. It's cheaper with a pen. That's the way lawyers tend to do it.
Right, exactly. That's good. But look, so it really does – you said, and we said at the beginning, laws are things that carry with them a kind of – I didn't put it this way, but prescriptive force. A law is the kind of thing to which you're subject, which you're supposed to obey. So these guys, whatever they say, I'm supposed to obey. That seems pretty powerful to me.
Oh, it's worse than that. I mean, I teach law, and I love law. But, you have to really see the dirt in it before you can grow to love it. I mean, the risk. That is, suppose a legislature says that we ought to do P. Then the claim is that we have reason to do P, and it would be wrong for us not to do P. On the other hand, had the legislature said we ought to do not P, then it's supposedly the case that we have reason not to do or reason to do not pay.
Right.
And so the reasons we have to act are independent of the content.
Right, exactly.
Of what the,
yeah.
Right.
You're listening. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our subject today is philosophy and the law. Our guest is Jules Coleman from Yale University.
We've been talking about what laws are, and we've had in mind laws that are passed by legislatures and enforced by governments. In the next segment, we'll talk about the relation between such laws and morality. Do we always have a moral obligation to obey the law? Do we sometimes have a moral obligation to disobey a law?
Law, morality, and your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Bobby Fuller IV and I Fought the Law. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Today we're discussing philosophy and the law. Join us. The number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Outside the Bay Area, call toll-free 1-800-525-9917.
What do you think about the law? Are you happy to live in a society that's a society of laws and not men? Do you have an opinion about what makes a law moral or immoral? Is it okay to disobey a law you feel is immoral? You can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org and give us your thoughts.
Our guest today is Jules Coleman from Yale University. Jules, I want to go back to the last thing you were saying. You said, well, look, the law gives you reason to do what it commands. You know, you say, why ought I to do that? Well, because it's the law. But the law could command pee or not pee, right? It's completely independent of your kind of antecedent interest or desires. But, you know, Thomas Aquinas, I think it was Aquinas, who said, an unjust law is no law. Suppose the law commands pee, and I think it's immoral, you know, to do pee. Doesn't that mean that law is, like, not valid anymore? It's a law in form, but not really a law. Isn't that right?
Is pee the best variable we could be using here?
Well,
I mean,
okay,
it looks like we're on the verge of dropping into obscenity,
so,
right?
So, look, is the law not constrained at all to be consistent with or to articulate moral principles?
Well, that's a very good question. I actually want to go back to the Bobby Fuller IV, you know.
Okay.
I write a lot about rock music. The best version of that song was done by The Clash, and Bobby Fuller committed suicide soon after that song. Yeah. Just a pertinent fact for the day.
Okay.
You know, it depends upon how you think about law. So here's one way of thinking about the way law is constrained by morality. Look, we all have a capacity for moral agency. We try to do and act according to the requirements of interpersonal morality. We see this in ourselves. We see that in others, or we aspire to it in ourselves and in others. The law tells us to do something that bears no relationship to what it is that we're required to do. As a matter of morality, it asks us, in effect, to act incoherently, inconsistently. It threatens our capacity for moral agency. And so its legitimacy, in a certain way, is constrained among moral agents by this fact about it. Namely, it has to make room, it has to accommodate our capacity for moral agency if it's to be defended, if it's to be the sort of thing which moral agents can respect. Now, does that mean all law does that, that all law everywhere does that? No, this is aspirational in a way, but it's something always to keep in mind. And to the extent to which law claims to be a legitimate authority, unless we take actors to be acting in bad faith, we should understand them to be aspiring to do that as best they can. And, you know, unless the mistakes they make are something that they wear, that are worn on the sleeves of the law, it's reasonable for us, under certain sets of conditions, to expect that that's what's going on.
So Jules, I'm having a little problem getting my mind around something. I mean, listening to your description of the law, it sounds like, well, it's a fact. There are these people that promulgate laws, and that for some historical reason count as a legitimate authority. They can promulgate any laws they want, limited only by under laws that have been promulgated. They can tell you to pee or not to pee, no matter what you feel like doing.
Not to do pee.
Anyway, and so So, I mean, so it's a fact. Mountains are facts, and valleys are facts, and swamps are facts, and laws are facts. No doubt about it. Then why do mm-hmm. we worship the law? Why are we so happy that we're in a government, or that at least we used to be in a society that is of laws and not men? Well, you said you love the law. Why do you love the law? I mean, why do you think this fact is worthy of any commendation at all?
Well, that's a very good question. So the question, in some way, law is a bunch of social facts that often depend on a variety of other social facts, historical accidents or power or what have you. And what is the grounds of these social facts garnering or securing some form of respect among ordinary folks like us?
Fear. Fear of the consequences.
Fear. Well, that, of course, was one of the very standard views for the longest time, namely that what's distinctive of law is the carrying around of a sanction, that it's a kind of command that is backed by a threat of sanction, that the heart of law is the power to sanction, which is in a power and not really an authority. And a contrasting view, and that was often associated with Hobbes or Bentham or Austin, and often associated with a position called legal positivism, which is, of course, much more sophisticated than that crude version of it. And in contrast, people are inclined to a different view as well, that ultimately legal authority is rooted in morality. If the law fails to provide some minimal moral content, if it doesn't make our lives better, if it doesn't lead us to experience fulfillment, gratification, satisfaction, make our lives morally more attractive to one another, if it doesn't embody some sense of justice, it's not legitimate whatever it claims for itself. Now, of course, the more that's false, the more it's the case that the law departs from the demands of morality, the more it's likely to impose sanctions on individuals in order to secure compliance. After all, morality applies to people all the time, and people are inclined to do what morality requires them to do, other things being equal. And if the law is going to depart tremendously from the demands of morality, the law is going to enforce its standards through sanctioning. And that sanctioning is a very expensive thing for the law to engage in.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. You can join this discussion. We're talking about law and philosophy with Jules Coleman of Yale University. You can join this discussion by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. We're eager to hear your voice. And Pablo in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Pablo.
I'm here.
Okay, what's your comment or question?
Well, one question. Thank you. Oh, you guys have a great show. I was recently graduated grad school in criminology, law, and society, so I love this fascinating topic. But, you know, one thing is laws change and morality changes, so I'd like you to incorporate that. But, you know, when I studied this subject, you know, I found out that the bulk of laws, let's just take our society right here and now, have to do with economic things. So I would posit that one thing is that the law is, largely a function of our economic system. And then another thing is that, in fact, there's a relationship between law and morality, in the sense that we want to think that we are a nation of laws, is precisely for the governance of individuals. And of course, there's a tie-in with morality. But what's your take on that? I'll take it off the air. Thanks so much,
Jules. There was a lot in there. What do you want to respond to in there?
Well, there are several things, right? I don't know if the law, if it's a causal claim that our economy has an enormous impact on which laws tend to be passed at any given time, but surely it's true that a certain segment of our legal rules are designed to regulate our exchange relationships with one another and to make markets possible. But the vast majority of laws, the things that we tend to think as paradigmatic instances of law, criminal law, tort law, law that tells us what our obligations are to others, what care we have to take when we're imposing risks, making drugs, driving cars, or what have you. Criminal law, prohibitions against assault, battery, fraud, these are not primarily best thought of as designed in some way to facilitate market exchanges, but to ensure that individuals, on the one hand, have a framework of security that surrounds them, which makes their investments in human capital and the like rational and reasonable for them.
But I think part of what was underlying Pablo's question, I'm not sure, Jules, but I think, look, some people believe, and I think I do in my most cynical moments. You talked about law being constrained by morality, but if you look at lawmaking and law enforcing, and you think, what are the interests that drive lawmaking and law enforcing and even law interpreting? It's the interest of the powerful, right? So the interest of corporations, of powerful economic actors, and there's nothing in the system of lawmaking that at all guarantees that it's going to track with the dictates of morality in the way that you were requiring. I mean, the Supreme Court can't say, oh, this law is immoral, and therefore we set it aside. If it's constitutional, it goes. If the police won't say, ah, it's an immoral law, therefore you don't go to prison for violating it. So there's really nothing in the system. Right. There's plenty in the system that makes the law track the economic interests of this or that class, but not much that makes the law track the dictates of morality. What do you think about that?
Well, I think the answer to that is yes and no. I mean, there are constitutional prohibitions which we can broadly think of as imposing moral constraints on the law, due process of law, equal protection of the law, which can be understood quite broadly to ensure certain sorts of equal treatment under the law, and which to a certain extent we plausibly can think of as imposing some sort of moral constraint. So, of course, the mere immorality of something isn't going to prevent it from being a law.
Well, you have to.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah, I mean, morality can be a contender here because morality can have some force. It doesn't have force just by being morality. It has force by the fact that people are trained to be moral as kids, so they feel strong about it. There are institutions like the church that, whatever you think about them, they claim to be and often are pushing a moral point of view. So even if law is a reflection of power relations, morality can be part of the system. I suppose that's one reason that it's a little hopeful to have a society of laws rather than just a society of men. It doesn't solve anything by itself, but at least permits an avenue for the various competing powers, some of which are good, to have a representation in what gets done and what gets allowed.
Wayne and Alameda's on the line. Oh, sorry. Okay. Do you want to?
I just want to say something. When you say you have a system of laws, you're not just saying something about particular laws and no relationship they have to one another. I mean, the laws have to be consistent. They have to provide warning in advance about what your liabilities are if you fail to comply. They can't demand the impossible of you. So a system of laws incorporates a certain number of moral virtues as a scheme of regulating our behavior in a way in which a set of rules or commands or authoritative statements by Jones or Smith or the guy in power don't. And so those are moral virtues which are incorporated into being governed by law as such.
Do you think, is that moral virtues that a democratic society committed to equality or something? Or is that just intrinsic to laws? If there were a monarchy and the laws mm-hmm. were just the dictates of the sovereign, would the sovereign in the same way be subject to these constraints in order for the laws to count as, legitimate?
Well, it's not even a question about whether it counts as legitimate. In some way, you might think it's an uninteresting semantic question about whether you think it's law at all. That is, it's a system of governing people, but whether it's a system of governing people by law is governance by law is a kind of a way of having your affairs regulated that is at least weakly commendable, in part because it is not pointed out or to particular persons. Laws are not passed against Ken Taylor or John Perry, though many people have thought this appropriate, at least in my case. They apply to people generally who have certain attributes, and this is just part of what we take to be governed by law. Now, a monarch, can govern by law, can govern by sanction, or govern by threat. Those are different ways of governing.
So if Hammurabi was presumably a pretty strong monarch, but if he committed himself that, well, still, I'm going to promulgate these laws, I reserve the right to change them at whim, but until I've changed them, they obtain. Well, then that's a sort of a government by laws, even though they're laws that are dictated by one man. I guess that would be preferable. At least you would know ahead of time what you could do and what you couldn't.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about philosophy and the law with Jules Coleman. You can join our discussion by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And Wayne in Alameda's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Wayne.
Thank you for taking my call. My question is, whose morality? if you talk to different people or different schools of thought, each one will tell you a different definition of what is moral. So who gets to choose?
Thanks, Wayne. Jules, you got an answer for Wayne there?
I do. I don't know if it's a good one. We want to distinguish between conventional morality and critical morality. That is, there are some things which are just really wrong to do, and when you and I disagree about them, it's not that we both believe that there's my morality and your morality as if we weren't really disagreeing with one another. We're actually disagreeing because we believe that each one of us has beliefs about what morality actually requires. I don't want to be a relativist about morality here. There really are requirements for morality, and we have differing beliefs about what they are. Who gets to choose is not who gets to choose what morality is, who may get to choose what the law is, but the law is still subject to criticism.
That's a big topic, Jules. You know, that's worthy of a show all of its own. Jeff in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Jeff.
Yes. Hi, sir. How are you doing?
Okay.
My question is in reference to an article written by Gil Deleuze called Postscripts on Society Control.
Okay.
It was commenting on Foucault. And so my question is, how do laws control in a new digital world? For example, the Internet and copyrights. Because laws up until now were dealing with analog and different types of old systems.
Well, so laws... laws are predicated on some certain assumptions about the way the world works, and the world keeps changing the way it works. That's a challenge for laws. I don't know how philosophical it is, but all things are philosophical. So what do you think about that, Jules?
The law has to accommodate technological. On the one hand, law accommodates technological change, and the question is whether it has the resources available within it, arguing by analogy to ask whether or not our constitutional provisions about free speech can just be taken as is to the world of the Internet, or whether the Internet just, as it were, changes things. We have to reconceptualize our notions of property, our notions of free expression and free speech. And I have nothing, particularly insightful to say about that, but this is nothing new. That is, it just seems more extensive now and more more distinctive now. But the need to the law being affected by technological change and the law needing to accommodate technological change is just a feature of legal practice generally.
Paul in San Francisco, welcome to Philosophy Talk, Paul.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'd like to say that my favorite version of the Bobby Fuller song was the Dead Kennedys version. Because the lyrics there say, "I fought the law and I won." But anyway,
that's not what my students say.
My question is, it has to do with the domain of the law. And there are two examples that, I kind of have in mind to illustrate this. One is our president's use of signing statements when he signs legislation, basically saying that he reserves the right to not obey the law if he chooses to. And the other example is Guantanamo Bay, where we have, outside of the, the domestic territory of the U.S., people being held without habeas corpus and whatnot, and our own legal system ruling that, the law doesn't apply to these actions of our own agents outside of, this territory. And to me, those raise questions about, what is, you spoke earlier about the virtues of the law, and how does this jive with that? I mean, is this really law?
Jules, I'm going to ask you to hold an answer for just a few seconds on that. Okay, you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing philosophy and the law with Jules Coleman.
So far, we've talked about what laws are and the relation between laws and morality. How do you feel about breaking unjust laws? Something you do all the time? Something you did in your youth? Something you'd never do?
Laws, just and unjust, plus the tradition of civil disobedience, and your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
The Heptones and Book of Rules. I'm John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're asking questions about philosophy and the law. We'd like you to ask questions, too. Join us, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
Outside the Bay Area, you can call toll-free, 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. You can finally email us, comments at philosophytalk.org.
So, Jules, I'm looking at my prompter here. Before the break, we had Paul's question, which I can't quite remember. Can you remember Paul's question? Or what you were going to say in response to Paul's question?
Yes.
Okay. So
I can remember that. I thought it was a very good question, and I probably have nothing useful to say about it, but I'm going to say something anyway. What I thought was extremely interesting about it was it reminded us of the following. Even if laws are made by people who have the authority to make them, and that's our set of legal resources, the question, what do they en masse require, what do they permit, is not something that is determined just by what courts say. The courts can be wrong about what the law requires. I mean, the law isn't just what the judges say it is, though most the jurisprudential view that the law is what the judge says it is, very common in American legal education and called American legal realism. It's a mistaken view that virtually everybody believes. But the fact that a judge says something, he may or she may be mistaken about that, even as a statement what the law is. But then the fact that she said it then has to go into our set of resources that count as binding authoritative standards that future judges have to take into account, the merely because this is a person who is authorized to say it. Now, judges can say that we have the authority to act outside the domain of our actual authority to act, and they're wrong. The president can say that he can free himself from responsibility to comply with the demands of the law, and he can be wrong about that, even if he is a relevant legal official. But the fact that he said it is now something that is part of our legal materials in the future, which is a very interesting fact about legal practice.
Well, in a way, Jules, this sets us back to our original question. You said which statements are laws, but there's also the question of what exactly is a statement. Now, let me give you a case, right?
Good.
I believe Justice O'Connor said that if a guy trades a gun for some drugs, then and the drugs are illegal, then he's committed a crime using a gun. And Justice Scalia said, that's stupid. That's not what they had in mind at all. And Justice O'Connor won. So that's, that seems an odd construal. But what determines who's right? Was it the ideas in the minds of the legislatures when they enacted it? Or is it what common language means? Or is it who voted which way of the Supreme Court? What decides of the various meanings that sentence that says you can't use a gun to commit a crime? What decides what's the law and what's just a misinterpretation of the law?
Well, extremely hard question that would involve asking me what's my theory of interpretation or what's the right way to understand the meaning of authoritative legal text.
But you could go ahead and take 15 or 20 seconds to answer. I mean, we're not trying to push you here.
Well, I think when plain meaning sometimes has some significant role. If I buy a gun, I'm not using a gun, I'm buying a gun. I'm inclined to think the answer to that is not whether or not that's what the legislature meant. I don't care what the legislature meant in that regard. It's just that that's not what it is to use a gun. That's what it is to buy a gun.
I want to go back to our roving philosophical reporter and the guy who makes a habit of civil disobedience. Here I am, a citizen, and there's this law promulgated by these people. I think is stupid, absurd, irrational, immoral, and I go ahead and disobey the law. Right, because I guess I have a higher calling. Is that all right by your lights? I mean, is that morally permissible or rational or what? Tell me how to think about civil disobedience.
I'll tell you when you get out of jail. But basically, I think the question, you have to start with a different question first. The law claims to be an authority over us. What are the conditions under which it would be reasonable or rational for us to accept it as an authority? Suppose we held the view something like the following. If I thought that I would do better on doing what was morally right or what reason demanded of me by complying in general with what the law required, what the authority required, rather than trying to balance the reasons all on my own and seeing how I come out, then it would be rational for me to accept the law as an authority, just like in the classroom it would be rational for students to accept you as a kind of theoretical authority, or John, you and I, we probably all believe that about ourselves, rightly or wrongly. Now, once we accept something as a practical authority, the question is, when is it reasonable for us, accepting something as a practical authority, to ignore its demands, ignore its dictates? Well, on the one hand, if you're accepting it as a rational authority, part of what that means is most of the time you're going to put to aside your own assessment of the underlying merits of the law, and that's going to put an enormous constraint on the reasonableness of your acting in defiance of it. It would have to wear its mistakes on its sleeve, so to speak, because if you have to inquire in every case underlying what are the underlying reasons, did they get it right, are they wrong about this, you're vitiating its claim to authority, yeah. And you're defeating the point of accepting it as an authority.
Larry in San Mateo is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Larry.
Yes, thank you. My question is about relative to the need for law to be consistent with morality. And the situation where you might have a law that either side, pro or con, could argue from a moral position, both moral imperatives on either side being commonly accepted, and so there could be a conflict, both of which are morally grounded. An example might be eminent domain, where either side might be looking to an underlying morality, but they're just in conflict. Does that need to be consistent with morality apply, and can it be applied at this level of specific laws, or is it just on the whole as a system of law on net needs to be consistent? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Would you like me to answer that?
Yeah, sure.
I think that's a great question because it invites us to think of the many ways in which law and morality are connected to one another. One of the things, of course, if we said to ourselves, why don't we just regulate our affairs by the demands of interpersonal morality, even if we could agree upon what they are? Well, you know, we get by in the world with an enormous amount of substantial moral disagreement about what ought to be done, and we seem to be able to get on with our lives in most ways when I disagree with my wife or my friends about what we ought to do. But often our lives in the social world require some final decision about things. And so one of the arguments often put forth for why we have law regulate our affairs by law is because law gives us final decisions on various things. It resolves for us conflicts where morality doesn't have an obvious resolution. Often enough, both sides of a controversial case or a dispute can have good moral reasons on both sides. And one of the things the law does is make a decisive answer. It doesn't claim that the argument on the side of one defeats the argument on the side of the other.
But Jules, that would suggest to me that the legislature owes to the populace at large, in many circumstances, great forbearance in choosing sides, right? Because mm-hmm. you said we get along with a lot of moral disagreement. So unless there's a reason to take sides where, you know, unless there's some kind of overwhelming reason to take sides where we know moral disagreement will persist, then we ought not to make it a matter of law. That's what that suggests to me.
Right. That's, of course, one of the great areas of conflict, right? Because a modest liberal state, to a certain extent, would be very careful as to where and in what domains of our lives it thought it ought to exercise its coercive powers for that and other reasons. On the other hand, people who are enthusiasts of particular moral points of view, for whom a particular moral position means an enormous amount, want to see that emblazoned, expressed, made emblematic in legislative action. And, of course, that's an enormous conflict between those of us who are inclined to a more liberal, modest view about what the state ought to do with respect to entering our private lives and enforcing an interpersonal morality, and those who think that moral standards of certain kinds, often controversial ones, need to be expressed through the coercive authority of the state. They get more force for doing so. That is a deep conflict.
Jules, on that note, I'm going to have to thank you for joining us. It's been a great conversation.
It's been a great pleasure for me, and I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Our guest has been Jules Coleman, professor of jurisprudence and philosophy at Yale University, co-author of the Oxford Handbook of Jurisprudence and the Philosophy of Law.
We also want to thank all the callers we didn't get a chance to talk to, and we had a number of emails that we didn't get to today. Thanks for contributing, nevertheless.
So, John, what's your last thoughts about philosophy and the law?
Well, you know, there's two attitudes towards philosophy. I mean, there's many attitudes towards philosophy, but there's the kind of the optimistic attitude that if we pull up the rock and look underneath it, and we'll see kind of a mess, but eventually we'll be able to make sense of the mess and we'll all feel good about it. So you pull up the rock and you look at, gee, law. It's a statement. It's not clear what a statement is. It's not clear why they're laws. Mostly they're laws because, some power struggle in the past was won by violence. But maybe philosophy can come along and make sense of it and make us all feel good about living in a land of laws. And the other point of view is best leave the rock alone. And I wasn't sure about that when we started, and I'm not sure about it now.
So you don't know whether we profited from turning over the rock or, you know. Well, my last thought is that I'm just not sure about this connection between law and morality. I'm just not sure. Thomas Aquinas said, you know, the natural law tradition holds that if it's unjust, it's not a law. Because a law purports to prescribe behavior to you. It purports to command your obedience, right? But if it violates the dictates of morality, in what sense does it even purport to command your obedience? So if it does violate the dictates of morality, it seems to me it's not really a law, right?
Well, but all violations aren't quite created equal. The law that says you can't smoke pot may ultimately be unjust, but I'm not going to protest it, and I feel obliged to obey it. But other laws, I mean, directly conflict with morality, and if we had more time, we could talk about those.
Do you really feel obliged to obey it, or do you feel bludgeoned into obedience because if you don't obey it, you'll get beat over the head? That's not really obligation, is it? That's just fear. You fear to disobey it.
Well, I don't feel bludgeoned, but if I like pop more, maybe I would.
This conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog.
You can download podcasts of our program from our website as well. When we ask Ian Scholz about the philosophy of law, he got all draconian on us. So here he is, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholz, most agree that one of the chief founders of modern democracy and law was a Greek magistrate called Solon. But we don't know much about his predecessor, a generation before, a man named Draco. We do know how Solon responded to him, though. Plutarch wrote that Solon repealed all Draco's laws, except those concerning homicide, because they were too severe and the punishment too great. It seems that Draco imposed the death penalty for pretty much anything, from murder and sacrilege to shoplifting and loitering. Draco himself, when asked about his insistence on the death penalty for crimes, is said to have responded, "Small ones deserve that, and I have no higher for the greater crimes." From this man, we now have the term draconian, referring to a punishment that way does not fit the crime. But at the time Draco was first made a magistrate, or archon, there was big trouble in Athens. There were laws, but they hadn't been written down. The nobles pretty much made judgments at their whim, and the lower classes were getting a little itchy around the halter, a revolt imminent, threatening to bring down Athens. So in 621 BC, the nobles appointed Draco as chief magistrate, or archon, to transcribe the oral laws, which he did, codifying them and producing a constitution for Athens with a major focus on crime and punishment. He was draconian to be sure, but he shifted the rule of law from blood feuds, vendettas, and aristocratic whims to the power of the state, helping to impose order in a chaotic world. From that time, it was the state alone and not a victim's family that was allowed to punish a murderer. As archon, he brought Athens law and order. As a matter of fact, the word anarchy originally meant simply without an archon. Now, the 4th century BC orator Demades stated that Draco wrote his laws in blood, not ink. But whether that referred to the bloody chaos before Draco took things in hand or the blood on his hands after is not clear. And however draconian we may judge him today, at the time he was tremendously popular, kind of the 7th century equivalent of Rudolph Giuliani. He was so popular, in fact, that he went to the theater one evening to be honored. This is according to the Suda, a 10th century encyclopedia, which may or may not be accurate. He was so popular that his enthusiastic supporters threw their hats and cloaks at him like he was a bullfighter or rock star. So many articles of clothing were thrown at him that he suffocated under their weight, died, and wound up being buried right there in the theater. Well, beware of Greeks bearing gifts, they say. I can't speak for Draco's laws at this remove, but the praise for him sure seems draconian to me. I gotta go.
That was Ian Scholes, Digging Deep, Digging Fast, The 60-Second Philosopher. Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Special thanks to Rujin Shin, Neil Van Leeuwen, Nicole Sawaya, Ben Temption, and Alan Farley. And to our senior consulting producer, Gordon Earle.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association.
And from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW, local public radio, San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.com.
I'm John Perry. And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.